Oye, the United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Margaret Barclay presiding. All of our business before this court draw near, and you shall be heard. God bless the United States and this Honorable Court. Please be seated.
Good morning. I'm Judge Bartley. On my right is Judge Greenberg. On my left is Judge Allen. We are here today for the matter of Burkhart v. Wilkie, docket number 16-1334. The issue before the court is whether the claimant, appellant, who is receiving dependency and indemnity compensation benefits pursuant to 38 U.S.C. 1151 is eligible for home loan benefits under 38 U.S.C. 3702. Would counsel for the parties please state your name and your appearance for the record, beginning with appellant's counsel.
Good morning, Judge Bartley. I'm Sean Toomey with Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher on behalf of appellant Sally A. Burkhart.
Thank you. And Secretary?
For the Secretary, Mark D. Gore, and with me at counsel's table is Richard Gable.
Thank you. Are the parties ready to proceed?
We are.
Okay. Each party will have 30 minutes to present their arguments. Mr. Toomey, do you wish to reserve any time?
Yes, 10 minutes, please.
Okay. All right. Mr. Toomey, you may proceed.
Good morning, Judge Bartley, Your Honors, may it please the Court. The Board in this case denied VA home loan guarantee benefits to appellant Sally A. Burkhart despite two important facts. One was that her husband, Mr. Dave Burkhart, the veteran in this case, had been and would still be entitled to those VA home loan guarantee benefits were he alive today, but for the fact that he died as a result of VA care. And the second important fact is that in 2007, the VA issued Mrs. Burkhart a certificate of eligibility establishing her entitlement to a VA home loan guarantee benefit in the first, and that's the second reason. And so this court should reverse the board's decision for three reasons. First, Mrs. Burkhart is eligible under 38 U.S.C. 3701b2 as a veteran in the first instance, due to her husband's death as a result of VA care. The statute, when read in conjunction with Congress's intent in enacting the provision, as well as Congress's intent in enacting 38 U.S.C. 1151, the only conclusion that it leads to is that Mrs. Burkhart would be eligible in the first instance. The second reason that Mrs. Burkhart should be entitled to the benefits is the home loan guarantee benefits is that she was issued a COE in 2007, and a separate statute, that's 38 U.S.C. 3721, the VA home loan guarantee provisions, incontestability provision, bars the VA from contesting the certificate that it issued to her previously. And the third reason, there are limited exceptions in that statute, Your Honors, and the VA's purported error in issuing the certificate is not one of them. And the third reason that this court should reverse the board's decision is that as a matter of equity, the wrongs that have been perpetrated on Mrs. Burkhart and her husband in this case, that is, the deprivation of his right to use, his constitutionally protected right to use the VA home loan guarantee benefit, as well as the VA revoking Mrs. Burkhart's COE on the 11th hour, the eve of her attempt to use it.
Let me ask you this. Is it not a matter of statutory construction you're asking us to employ with regard to the words as if? Isn't that the central claim here? Congress said that persons in Mrs. Burkhart's category should have the same rights as if the veteran had died as a result of service-connected injury or wound.
That's correct, Judge Greenberg. And under 3701B2, the home loan guarantee benefit extends to surviving spouses and veterans.
So we're being asked centrally to decide what the words as if mean in this context.
In the context of the first reason that I raised.
All right. Now, do we need to, can we decide this case on the basis of reason number one, for example, that the words as if, given their plain meaning, are unmistakable?
Absolutely.
What about reasons number two and three? If we answer yes to reason number one or grounds number one, do we have to reach two and three? And should we?
So,
with regard to letting the world know how the court feels or how the court interprets the statutory scheme.
So, Judge Greenberg, to your first point, if you answer the first question in our favor, there is no need to reach the second and third questions. However, our position is that it would benefit veterans in similar positions if the court did reach questions two and three. There may perhaps be other veterans who are issued a COE in error down the road, find themselves in the same shoes, but don't necessarily have the same facts on their side as
all right, what about the reverse? What if the court feels differently than you're arguing about the meaning of the word as if? Is equity alone sufficient to give a remedy for Mrs. Burkhart?
So, yes, Judge Greenberg, not only is equity alone sufficient, but as well, 38 U.S.C. 3721 is an absolute bar to what the Secretary is trying to do in this case, regardless of how you answer the first question. That is, even if Mrs. Burkhart is ineligible in the first instance, there's a clear statute that's clear on its face that says the Secretary can't do what it's trying to do here, which is contest previously issued certificate of eligibility. Now, and as well as to the point of equity, regardless of what the court construes 3701B2 or 3721 to mean, the court still has the power and should, in our view, award her this benefit based on the equitable considerations.
So what about this? I mean, assume for the moment that our equitable power is limitless, as it would be in an Article III court setting. What are the factors that should impel us to exercise that power here? What are the facts that we should address?
Assuming the power was limitless, Your Honor, first of all, Mr. Burkhart, it's undisputed in this case that Mr. Burkhart, the veteran, was entitled to these benefits.
But did he ever apply for them? Did he ever apply for a home loan guarantee?
Your Honor, there is some suggestion in the transcript before the board hearing that he may have. Fortunately, there was nothing in the record that such an application or anything of that sort.
It seems the record was held open for the. I wasn't clear whether whether Mrs. Burkhart was going to submit some evidence of that or whether the VA was going to look for evidence of that.
So, just broadly, my understanding, and I wasn't counsel below, but my understanding is that she believes that there may have been an application, but wasn't able to actually find anything, and I don't know that the VA did either.
Does it matter whether he had actually applied?
No, it doesn't.
He's dead. He was dead at the hands of the VA. That's the statute we're talking about, right?
That's absolutely right. Our position is that he was entitled to the benefit. He would still be entitled to it if he were sitting here today. And the only reason he's not sitting here today is he died as a result of VA care. Ergo, he's been deprived of that benefit.
Could I ask you about your first argument for a second? So,
yes,
sir. Just the statutory argument about entitlement. So, Judge Greenberg mentioned as if. And so 1151 seems to say we're going to treat an 1151-type injury or death as if it were service-connected for certain purposes. Right? So under 1151A, it refers to this chapter, so Chapter 11 and Chapter 13. Okay? Now, an argument that the parties didn't take on in their brief is, though, 1151C, because 1151C says that a qualifying additional disability will also be under Chapter 21 for specially adapted housing, Chapter 39 relating to automobiles. Okay? So I've got a question about this. So first of all, you agree that the home loan guarantee is not in any of those chapters?
We would agree it's not specifically enumerated, yes.
It's not generically enumerated in any of those chapters.
Chapter
either.
37 is not specifically enumerated in the statute, which I think is what you're saying.
Right, and so, well, actually my question was, so the home loan guarantee part is only in Chapter 37. It's not in any of these, right?
That are specifically enumerated in the statute.
Right.
That is correct.
So my question is this. Subsection C was added to the statute in the wake of the Kilpatrick decision at the Federal Circuit.
That's right, Your Honor.
Right, and so Kilpatrick dealt only with Chapter 21 benefits, specially adapted housing, right?
Yes.
Isn't it really significant that when Congress enacted an amendment to Section 1151 in the wake of Kilpatrick, it didn't just add Chapter 21, it also added Chapter 39, something that wasn't at issue in Kilpatrick. So in other words, Congress at that time looked and didn't add Chapter 37. Isn't that a significant thing that we have to take into account in terms of what Congress intended with 1151?
Oh, well, Judge Allen, I don't want to misspeak, but I believe that the Chapter 39 benefit had been at issue previously in Kilpatrick, but it wasn't before the Federal Circuit. And so when Congress went back and looked at this question, that was another one of the benefits that had come up originally in the case.
So, but
that's my understanding. I don't want to.
And that may be right, but my point is that Congress, in the wake of Kilpatrick, had an opportunity to go back and decided to add other chapters. So instead of adding Chapter 37, or perhaps just taking out reference to any chapters and just leaving as if service-connected period, which would have, you know, encompassed all of Title 38,
sure.
Isn't this significant on the first argument in terms of congressional intent?
I think it's significant in the sense that it lends credence to the notion that Congress didn't intend 1151 compensation to encompass all benefits, and where they didn't go back and add the language that you just suggested. But I don't think the fact that they weren't even looking at Chapter 37, so I don't think we can draw much from the fact that they didn't specifically add that, because it wasn't one of the benefits at issue at all, ever, in Kilpatrick.
So how do you get under 1151, how do you get to Chapter 37 being included? Assuming, now, you may disagree with this, but I don't think you do, because your brief didn't say anything about this, and we've looked pretty closely. Unlike the issue in Kilpatrick, the Chapter 37 benefit was never at any point included in Chapter 11 and then moved around, right?
That's my understanding, Your Honor.
Right, okay. So how do you get under the language of 1151? This does not have anything to do with your incontestability argument or the equity argument, right? But how under the statute itself do you get to Chapter 37 when four chapters are mentioned and none of them are Chapter 37?
Sure. So 1151 has to be read in conjunction with the intent behind 3701, which as we explained in our brief, that Congress specifically intended to prevent what happened here from happening. The veteran was deprived of the use of his benefits through no fault of his own, through his death in VA care. And so it would be contrary to that intent in enacting 3701, the predecessor of 3701, which became 3701.
Would that be true for every benefit in which 1151 was the basis for an award and the veteran died? Wouldn't that encompass every single benefit in Title 38? In other words, for any benefit that veteran would have been entitled to get, he or she can no longer get it because of the negligent VA care, right? So wouldn't that be for everything?
Not necessarily, Judge Allen, and because in 3701B2, it's limited to, there's a provision in 3701B2 that defines veteran to include the surviving spouse of a veteran who died from a service-connected disability. So you don't have that necessarily in every other benefits.
But you agree it would apply without limit to someone who meets the definition of surviving spouse.
In 3701?
Yes.
Correct, yes.
Well, tell me a little bit more about your congressional intent argument, because, of course, when Kilpatrick was issued, I think it's fair to say it wasn't clear whether specially adapted housing or the home adaptation grant were things that would be included as benefits for under 1151. And wasn't congressional intent part of the analysis of the courts as to why it was determined to be included?
That's absolutely right.
So tell me a little bit more about your congressional intent.
So here it's twofold. One with 1151, which I believe we've discussed, to protect the veterans as if they were service connected. But with respect to 3701 in particular, which is, I believe, what you're asking about.
Right.
With respect to 3701 in particular, there's clear, and I think there's clear evidence in the legislative history that Congress didn't intend veterans to be deprived of these VA home loan guarantee benefits through no fault of their own, which is exactly what occurred here.
But that was why I asked earlier about whether he ever applied, because that seemed to be part of your argument was, well, he would have been eligible if he had lived, but he died due to VA's fault, which is, that second part is fact. He died due to VA fault.
Right.
No treatment, okay. Maybe it wasn't fault. Maybe it was the unforeseen event. But at any rate, he died because of their treatment. But you seem to be saying, well, he would have been entitled, but we're not sure whether he ever even applied. So part of your argument is he was deprived of something, but if he never applied, then what was he deprived of?
Well, Your Honor, I think our position is that he never had a chance to apply. When Mrs. Workhart applied later, several years later, he was no longer alive because he died as a result of VA care. There's nothing in the statute that says you only have X number of years or you must apply for a home, at a certain time. The benefits doesn't expire. So when they decided to purchase a home, he was no longer around to use the benefit. I don't see why. We don't believe there's any reason that he should be required to have tried to use it before. It's not as if the statute says, within X number of years of your service, you must use it or lose it. It's not.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. I guess my thought is that the deprivation that you're talking about, we're not really sure that it occurred because it doesn't appear that he ever tried to use the benefit.
But another way of, sorry, Judge. Another way of looking at it would be his state of mind is irrelevant as long as he had the benefit. There's no statute of limitations, no limitation whatever on the benefit to him. So whether he would have used it 50 years later, 10 years later, never, but she did.
Absolutely.
And we're asked to resolve that.
Absolutely.
Situation.
Judge Greenberg, I agree with you completely. And Judge Bartley, I think the issue that we would have with what you're saying is that it unfairly imposes a requirement on the veteran to have sort of attempted to use the benefit or done something like that, where there's just no such requirement in the statute. And the other thing to keep in mind is, were he still alive when Mrs. Burkhardt attempted to use the benefit, that we wouldn't be here because he would have been able to use it. And so that's what he's being deprived of. I think it's fair to say that when Mrs. Burkhardt decided, to purchase a home, he wouldn't have had an issue with her using the benefit to help them do that as a family.
I'm sorry I'm being dense on this, I think. And so try to help me because I think my colleagues are seeing this differently than I am. I don't understand the relevance at all of, for equity purposes, I understand your point, okay?
Sir.
But in other words, I understand the point you're making about the fact that he's been deprived of something that he might have used or tried to use or didn't try to use, whatever. I understand that for equity purposes. That seems unfair, right? I'm there. For the life of me, I am not following this argument with respect to what it matters for statutory construction, right? Because Chapter 1151, right, says as if service-connected for four chapters, 11, 13, 23, and 21 and 39. Right? We're talking about a benefit in Chapter 37. Yes, Chapter 37 says a veteran defined to be a surviving spouse, right? Great. Except Chapter 1151 provides the service connection hook for only those four chapters. So I just don't understand the fact that I understand it for equity purposes, but I do not understand it for statutory construction. So can you help me?
Yeah, I think I understand your question, Judge Allen. And what I would say is, with respect to the statutory construction issue, our position is that it's an absurd construction of the statute to exclude those veterans, the surviving spouses of those veterans, because essentially what that means is the VA can cause the death of a veteran with impunity. The veteran's benefits can just be extinguished, whereas under our construction of the statute, it would impute to the surviving spouse under that language in 3701B2, and that avoids the absurd result under the Secretary's interpretation of the statute.
And sorry, Judge.
Oh, I'm done.
Isn't it more consistent with congressional intent to read the statutory scheme your way than any other way? In other words, Congress could have expressly excluded the VA mortgage benefit, but it didn't. And just because it included four chapters and didn't include another six chapters or another 20 benefits, or benefits that were unknown at the time but were later added. And if the veteran had been alive, he would have been the beneficiary of it.
That's absolutely right, Judge Greenberg, and that's where 1151...
That's what you're asking us to do by way of what Judge Allen is suggesting, in other words, the statutory construction
that's
argument.
That's reading that statute in connection with... Yes, exactly. Right.
And by the way...
Counsel, I see that your time has almost expired. Let's add 5 minutes.
Thank you, Judge Greenberg.
Do you think that any one of the three reasons that you're suggesting or arguing that the court should hold your way are equal in legal strength?
Are any of them equal?
Yeah, are all of them given the same weight? In other words, if the court were to... It seems to me that you've structured it sort of in a hierarchical... Statutory construction A, statutory construction B, equity C.
That's right, Your Honor.
Is it possible for the court to pick any one of those three and be correct?
Of course.
All right.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Could you just, in the time you've got left, move from your argument number one to argument number two, the incontestability? So my question about that is there isn't much law on this provision. There is a similar provision, I think, for the Federal Housing Administration or something like that. And there is a case that construed a very similar incontestability provision, a district court case from Indiana or Illinois, somewhere in the great middle part of the country with an I, that looked at the incontestability provision there. And what it determined is that the incontestability was designed to make a secondary market for these loans. In other words, the concern was banks had made the loans, that the banks had reached their capacity, but they weren't, other entities, private entities, weren't willing to buy the loans because they didn't have tremendous faith in the guarantee. And so the guarantee was made incontestable in order to create a secondary market. And that logic would suggest that the incontestability provision was directed at after the loan had been issued to provide confidence to the lender or the secondary market. And I'm just interested in your take on that interpretation of incontestability.
Certainly, Judge Allen. So I'm not familiar with this specific case or statute that you're mentioning, but assuming for the moment that the purpose is similar with 3721, which we don't concede, but assuming for the moment it is, the issue with getting into this nebulous purpose type analysis is if you look at the very first sentence, the incontestability provision itself in 3721, it's not limited in that fashion. Whereas later, the first sentence says, any evidence of guarantee issued by the Secretary shall be conclusive evidence of the eligibility of the loan for guarantee.
Now, the eligibility isn't determined. Eligibility is not contingent on whether the loan's been issued or not.
Well, but so, doesn't it say the eligibility of the loan, right? It doesn't
yes.
say the eligibility of the person, right?
Correct. But so in this case, Mrs. Burkhart sought a loan from a lender, and that loan, the COE rendered that loan eligible for VA guarantee. And our understanding is that when the lender went to verify with the VA, the VA wouldn't honor the COE, and that's why the loan, that issue that we're talking about here, was not issued. So I don't think that the loan lends any credence to that notion that it has to have been issued, because there's still the loan that you're seeking when you're a loan applicant. And I think, to your point, Judge Allen, in the last sentence of 3721, which is not the incontested ability provision itself, but which relates to the Secretary's ability to establish further defenses, there it does mention issuance. So Congress clearly knew how to reference issuance of a loan if it wanted to. It did it in the third sentence. It didn't do it in the first one. So that's our position is the plain language of the statute governs here, and it's there's just nothing in there to suggest that a loan has to be issued in order for it to apply.
Now, Don, would you please add another 5 minutes? I'm glad that Judge Allen moved on to your second argument, because that involves the December 2007 Certificate of Eligibility. Now, do Certificates of Eligibility ever expire?
My understanding is that they don't expire, but that sometimes a lender will sort of recheck with the VA. If
too old. The information that it was based on is too old.
To make sure. Stop me if I'm going on a tangent, Your Honor, but there's a VA lender's manual that the Secretary said in his brief, pamphlet 26-7, which tells lenders the only evidence of a guarantee that you can use is a COE. And so it's on the lender to verify that the COE is accurate when they're issuing the loan. And so my understanding of what happened is given the age of the COE, the lender called up the VA to say, hey, everything good here, because that's all they can look at.
So your argument is that 3721 binds VA to abide by the 2007? Is that the 2007 certificate, determination there?
Yes, that the VA can't contest the eligibility of the loan she's seeking under that certificate, which is exactly what they did here.
And is there anything in the legislative history of 3721 that would support your argument?
The legislative history of 3721 is beyond sparse, Judge Barley. It does say that, and this is cited in our brief, the provision that 3721 was added in order to render the evidence of guarantee, which is a COE, incontestable. And that seems pretty clear.
The board did not mention the 2007 Certificate of Eligibility. Would there be any benefit, in your view, to remanding for the board to address the expirability, if that's a word, or the non-expirability of certificates of eligibility, or any issues surrounding the 2007?
If I understand your question correctly, Judge Bartley, would it benefit for the board to address whether the COE had expired or not? If that's the question, I don't know that it would, because I think, as the Secretary has said in their own brief, that the COEs don't expire, and so there's nothing, there's nothing.
But the impact of that on the later application for, because she did submit a separate application in 2013, I think?
After the VA refused to honor the first one, yes.
Right. So for the board to address the impact of the unexpired 2007 COE on her current effort.
So, Judge Riley, just to be clear, I understand what you're asking. I believe the board acknowledged that the VA had issued a COE in 2007. I think there's a sentence in their decision that says that, and they find it of no moment.
Specifically find it of no moment,
they
had mentioned it.
They mentioned it. I can they mention it in passing and say, you know, something to the, I'm paraphrasing, but something to the effect of, despite the fact that, you know, we recognize that she had been issued this certificate, but she's still not eligible. So I think where the board's mistake was is conflating the issue, which the secretary does in his brief as well, is conflating the issue of entitlement in the first instance to whether or not the secretary can contest a certificate issued to an ineligible, to a supposedly ineligible applicant. So I think those are, does that make sense? I think those are separate.
So you think that a remand for the board to discuss these issues would be of no assistance?
I wouldn't say it's of no assistance, Your Honor, but I don't know that there's a need for it, given that the court can just reverse, because it's a matter of law that the 3721 prohibits the secretary from contesting this, the 2007 COE, and there's really nothing for the board to discuss.
Okay.
What impact, if any, moving in your last extra 2 minutes here to your third argument, what impact, if any, is the Federal Circuit's discussion in Burris about the fact that the equitable remedies that were sought in that case, the Federal Circuit determined came within the precise scope of the description of the Secretary's equitable powers that Congress granted in the statute? It seems like the same argument could be made here.
So I may have leave to respond fully to you, Judge Allen. I've only got about 40 seconds.
If my boss, Judge Hartley, agrees, it's all good with me. So
thank you, Your Honor.
I'll add another 5 minutes.
Now I've lost my train. Two things on that point, Your Honor. First of all, in Burris, the court was crystal clear that it's only talking about monetary benefits. This just isn't a monetary benefit. It doesn't require a payment of a dime. Whereas in Burris, what the claimants were seeking was money from the VA. That's just not this case.
Let me just have you there. That I agree with
okay.
you. I agree, and I'm going to ask the Secretary about the difference between
Understood.
Something that could be lead to money. But I read Burris as having a separate argument that says, hey, what you're asking for, regardless of whether it's money or not, is precisely in 503.
I think I understand where you're going with that, Judge Allen, and what I would say is, we don't agree that that falls within the language of 503, but even if it did, here the equitable considerations aren't limited to the fact that they refused to honor this COE they've issued to her. It's also jumping back to our earlier discussion that Mr. Burkhardt was entitled to this benefit. The only reason he's not here to use it today, and he'd still be entitled to it, the only reason he's not here to use it today is that he died as a result of VA care. Nothing like that's within 503. So the Secretary doesn't have equitable power to do anything about that. Only this court does. So even if we don't agree that 503 encompasses the relief vis-a-vis the COE, but even if it did, the facts of this case still call for the court to exercise equitable power that the Secretary doesn't have. Excuse me.
Great. I just wanted to give you a chance to respond to that.
Did that fully?
Yes, I understand your position. Absolutely.
One other point on, if I may jump back for a second, to Section 3721 is I think we don't want it to be lost on the court that what the Secretary is trying to do here is grant himself an exception for COEs issued in error. That's just not in the statute. The statute 3721 gives the Secretary the power to set by regulation other defenses. They set it for COEs that are not issued by the government, ones that are forged, or ones that are procured through misrepresentation. They just as easily could have said ones that the Secretary issues by mistake, but they didn't do that.
But that all presupposes incontestable as to whom, right? Because if the incontestability provision, and there is legislative history about this, in which Congress talks about creating a secondary market for GI loans, right?
Right.
So if it's only dealing with incontestability as to a lender, then the idea about adding a defense is not applicable here, right, because the whole provision wouldn't have been kicked into place.
Then it doesn't, under your hypothetical where it doesn't apply, right, then it
would. Right.
Right. But, and I, you know, there's no need to I think you understand our position, but there just isn't that limitation in the text of the statute.
So your view is that 3721 would, in essence, prevent VA from finding under 3.1, assuming your interpretation of 3721 is correct, would VA then be prevented from finding, you know, under 3.105A, clear and unmistakable error in an earlier determination of eligibility, or somehow finding that they had made a mistake? And aren't they always allowed to correct their mistakes via a determination that it was the benefit was wrongly granted?
So I don't know that it would prevent. So the VA can make the determination that there's been a mistake, but there's a statute that says it doesn't matter. The fact that you've made a mistake, that doesn't matter. This isn't about 3721 is not about eligibility for the benefit, right? It's about we the secretary cannot contest the COE we've issued whether you were eligible for the benefit or not. So I think those are going to two different.
Do you mean not contest it or not correct
not,
it?
Not contest the eligibility of the loan that the COE holder is seeking for VA guarantee, whether that person was entitled to the COE in the first instance or not.
So in your view, 3.105, which would allow VA to correct its own error, is not applicable?
Our position would be that 3721 controls over.
Your position is, yes, it's not applicable.
Yes, 3721 controls over the regulation.
Okay.
Yes, Judge Greenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Toomey. Mr. Gore, you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Sections 1151 and Section 3701, are both clear and unambiguous on their face. Section 3701B2 allows some, but not all, surviving spouses of veterans to obtain VA home loan benefits. As relevant here, Section 3701B2 restricts the availability of home loan benefits to the survivors of veterans whose deaths were actually service-connected. Section 1151 does allow the provision of certain benefits in the same manner as if, in this case, a death was service-connected, but it's important to look at all of the language of Section 1151. It doesn't include, in Section 1151A, it doesn't include the broad treated-as-if language that is cited, that is noted throughout appellant's briefing presentation. Rather, it says compensation shall be provided in the same manner as if a death or disability was service-connected. And compensation is a specifically defined term in Title 38. In 38 U.S. Code, Section 101, Paragraph 13, defines compensation as a monthly monetary benefit paid as a result of service-connected disability. And service connection is also a specifically defined term.
Well, but certainly 1151 goes beyond what you've just described as the definition of compensation, right?
Other paragraphs of 1151 do, Your Honor. Yeah,
right, that's what I mean.
1151A is restricted to compensation. As you noted, Section 1151C does indeed go beyond that, and Section 1151C does actually contain the broad treated-as-if language. But as you note, that's specifically restricted to two particular chapters, 21 and 39, pertaining to automobile and home adaptation benefits. And it's telling that when, as you noted, Judge Allen, when Congress amended Section 1151 in 2004, it added that broad treated-as-if language, but left Paragraph A intact, Paragraph A and its more restrictive compensation-as-if language. It left that intact. And even going beyond the fact that Congress only noted two particular chapters in Paragraph C, when Congress enacted that, provided that amendment to Section 1151, Congress also amended Chapter 37. Chapter 37 home loan benefits were clearly on Congress's mind at that time. They amended two different sections of Chapter 37 at that time. Congress didn't just overlook home loan guarantee benefits. It's clear by adding only two particular chapters at a time when they were thinking of Chapter 37, they intended to not include Chapter 37 in 1151's purview. And that is entirely in keeping with the purpose of Chapter 37. Chapter 37 is included in subpart 3 of Title 38, which refers to readjustment benefits for people exiting the military. These are benefits provided to service members to allow them to move from the more cabined military life to readjust to civilian life, and home loan benefits fit nicely within that rubric, whereas 1151-type benefits, where someone's simply injured in a manner that's attributable to VA care, doesn't implicate that readjustment. It makes perfect sense with Congress's enactment of these readjustment benefits to limit 1151 under paragraph A as not pertaining to those type of readjustment benefits.
What about the sort of, this is sort of the elephant in the room, it's sort of the practical question. Practical is the wrong way to put it, but, you know, the argument that it's VA's, quote, fault, right, I'm going to use that term generically, right, that this veteran isn't around to use the benefit anymore, and whether that gets plugged into statutory interpretation or gets plugged into equity, what about that argument?
Well, initially, and I think you kind of gave a nod to this in premising your question, it is at the very most debatable on this record whether Mr. Burkhart's death here is due to VA's fault. But regardless of that, it certainly is attributable to VA care under Section 1151. But ultimately, it's irrelevant here. Section 1151 speaks to deaths that are attributable to VA care, whether due to fault or something else. Congress and Congress alone defines the scope of benefits that flow from injuries or deaths, or disabilities or deaths, rather, flowing from VA care. And Congress made the policy decision to limit the type of compensation available flowing from 1151. It limited it in paragraph A to compensation under chapters 11 and 13, and in paragraph C to home and automobile adaptation.
Where's your support for what Congress intended? Isn't that our job?
It is your job, Your Honor, but Congress's intent is clear on the face of the statute. Again, as this Court has held in Mintz and in Al-Iman, and as the Federal Circuit also held in Al-Iman, Section 1151A is clear and unambiguous on its face as not conveying the status of service connection. It simply allows for an exception to the rule of Section 101.
Well, what do the words as if mean?
They mean that compensation under chapters 11 and 13 will be paid in the same manner as if the death or disability, as the case may be, were service connected.
And you're saying that the word compensation has a specific, unique meaning?
It does, Your Honor.
And that's what Congress intended.
Congress
if,
used
by the words as if are limited by the word compensation in the definitions section.
Yes, Your Honor, clearly. You'll bear with me one moment to get the statute in front of me. Paragraph A says compensation under this chapter, being Chapter 11, and dependency and compensation under Chapter 13 shall be awarded in the same manner as if. The award is to proceed as if it were service-connected for purposes of Chapters 11 and 13. And Congress specifically used the word compensation, which Congress has specifically defined in Section 101, as referring to a monthly monetary benefit. Compensation is not used in, I guess, kind of the tort-type context, referring to damages that might flow from a death attributable to VA care. But compensation here means
apart from your argument, what do you have to suggest that that's what Congress intended? This extremely narrow and limited definition of compensation.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, it's not just my argument. It's this Court's holding in Mintz, Al-Iman, and
the Federal Circuit's holding. We're here today.
That's true, Your Honor, but of course the Federal Circuit binds this Court in its decisions, and the Federal Circuit held in Al-Iman exactly to that effect, that it does not convey the status of service connection, but rather refers to compensation under chapters 11 and 13, consistent with the plain language of the statute. But moreover, just to glean further evidence of Congress's intent, again, we would look at paragraph C and the 2004 amendment that Congress enacted, where, again, it left that restrictive language of paragraph A intact while adding the more broad language.
All right, let's assume for the moment that you're correct. Well, 2004, didn't that precede the 2007 grant of the COE here?
It did.
Didn't the VA know? Didn't the VA have your interpretation of compensation when it issued this certificate of eligibility in 2007?
It did.
So did it make a mistake?
It did.
And too bad for Mrs. Burkhart? Is that your argument?
Regrettably.
In other words, you're arguing for an extremely specific reading of a statute which goes back to 1944, frankly, in terms of the benefits intended to be conferred by Congress, not only upon veterans, but a whole group of people, including spouses, children, and so forth. So they made that mistake in 2007. How do you explain the mistake? Or maybe the VA bureaucracy had a different interpretation than the one you're arguing now.
I can't explain the mistake, Your Honor.
Maybe it wasn't a mistake. Maybe they viewed the congressional intent differently than you're arguing it now. It's 3 years after Congress made this amendment.
Your Honor, it was a mistake on VA and on VA's part, and it's not evidence of a contrary interpretation of Section 1151. If you'll bear with me while I find this in the record.
Well, who should bear... I don't mean to interrupt, but don't struggle to find it. I believe whatever you're saying.
I found it.
I'm sure you're arguing... Don't mistake it. We're assuming that the VA is acting in good faith. Arguing here, certainly in good faith. It's a legitimate argument to be made, but we have to make a decision. So what are we to do here on just on that narrow ground of we issue this, the VA issues this certificate of eligibility. There's this incontestability statute. And then there is the question of equity or what's fair. Mm-hmm. So, your argument on that? On
if
those
I could answer
points?
Your first question first, and I'll get to your second one. With respect to whether VA simply made a mistake or whether the issuance here was evidence of a contrary interpretation, in the notice letter awarding DIC benefits to Ms. Burkhart on Record 274, there's included a separate paragraph specifically explaining that because this is a DIC benefit granted under Section 1151, it does not carry entitlement to ancillary benefits with it. That was clearly explained to Ms. Burkhart. The subsequent determination actually cites that award in granting the benefit, and there's simply an irreconcilable disconnect between those two. So I think it is fairly obvious on the record that it was a mistake that was made as opposed to VA acting according to some interpretation of 1151.
Well, let me ask you this.
Court's holding.
I don't mean to interrupt you so that you lose your thought, but it actually connects to my question. So who should bear the burden of this mistake? Can you explain how the mistake was made?
I can't explain how the mistake was made.
Is it a clerk at some regional office that did it? How does it work? How do these certificates of eligibility work? I mean, there's a vast 350,000 employees.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how many of them are devoted to putting out paper like this as opposed to compensation, mm-hmm. as you would describe it, or medical care and so forth. Where are all these determinations made? Central headquarters here in Washington?
Determinations.
Determinations as to certificates of eligibility for these home loan benefits. Where are they made?
At an entity called the Regional Loan Center. It's the analog to what we typically see as regional offices in the context of disability compensation. There's a specific... I guess I'll just call it an office, called the Regional Loan Center.
Is there one for every state, for example, the way there are regional offices for mm-hmm. your basic
My understanding
veterans
is
benefit?
That these are centralized.
So how many of them are there?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor.
Is there a dozen, 50, 25, 3?
Again, I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor. But with respect to how these COEs are typically issued,
yes.
there's quite a lot underneath that. With respect to most veterans, COEs aren't issued. If you look at Section 3702C, 3702A, it explains that for most people that are involved in the VA home loan system, a DD-214 functions as a COE, as a certificate of eligibility. It simply acts as prima facie evidence of one's veteran status. And that's the, obviously Department of Defense issues those. VA has no involvement in those. When there's some question involving whether there's eligible service, whether length of service, character of service, then there would be an application made to VA for determination of eligibility and, in appropriate cases, the issuance of a COE. And in those decisions, just like any other decision, it's regrettable, but sometimes mistakes are made. VA is an agency run by humans, and humans
okay, so what happened here? Did Mrs. Burkhart present the DD-214 of her husband? Her dead husband, the dead veteran. What happened here?
When she applied, she referenced Mr. Burkhart and his service, included his service information. And so obviously there was inquiry into the nature of his service. But, of course, for determining her eligibility as opposed to his,
right,
the nature of his service is no longer relevant because, regrettably, he is no longer with us. Ms. Burkhart has to demonstrate her own independent basis of entitlement under Chapter 37.
And what is that? What did she present? Or what was... What does your manual say she was supposed to present? Did she present it before this mistake was made?
Her application is in the record, Your Honor.
Are you contesting the completeness of the application?
No, certainly not.
The veracity of the statements made in the application?
No, her application is at record 748, and she notes in Block 10 that she's claiming that the cause of her husband's death was service-connected, and she herself noted that it was under Section 1151.
But did the VA look behind that to see whether it was a DD-214 with an honorable discharge? And other than a dishonorable discharge means he's not entitled to it.
I wouldn't think that VA did look behind that to his DD-214 because it's not relevant. Because Section 3701B2 says that for surviving spouses such as Ms. Burkhart, the relevant fact is the nature of the death, whether it's service-connected. That's the only fact.
So it basically presumes service-connected because it was at the hands of the VA administering this medical care.
I'm sorry?
It's because you're applying the statute. If you die while in the care of the VA, it's as if it were service-connected. That's the statute we're...
Compensation. Oh,
yes.
As if
well, you're arguing compensation, and we'll skip over that for the moment. But that's the statute we're talking about.
Yes.
Right.
3701B.
Okay, so what does the VA do to double-check on that she's telling the truth? She didn't make a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
You know, her husband came back. Can't imagine she said, let's see your DD-214 mm-hmm. now that you're back from the Korean War. Honey.
Well, as to what VA did here to discover its error, it's not in the record as to what exactly prompted VA, what was obviously a second look at Ms. Burkhart's eligibility here, but...
Why isn't that important? Why shouldn't we know what the VA did or didn't do, either in the context of statutory construction or a matter of equity?
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, we do know what VA did here. It discovered that...
How?
Well, again, that's a gap in the record.
An important gap, don't you think?
I don't, Your Honor, because what matters is that the error was found, and what matters is the proceedings and the actions flowing from that. The way these requests for COEs typically work, and this is in the VA Lender's Manual 26-7, is typically these are done via electronic interface with banks, because by and large, for substantially all banks, the burden of showing the various showings that are necessary to issue a loan under Chapter 37, such as eligibility as a threshold matter, the appropriate purpose of a loan, a veteran's creditworthiness, all of those factors, those findings are typically made by banks, and those are just then certified to VA after the fact, and VA issues evidence of guarantee following that. So what? And again, this isn't the record. This is me filling in
You're
blank.
Speculating
That's,
now. At the moment.
That is correct, Your Honor. I'm
fair enough, but you're telling us you're speculating what might have happened, what must have happened, what could have happened.
What, in my view, likely happened was Ms. Burkhart
went to the bank.
She applied for a loan. And in the bank's exercise of its typical duties that it would do for any loan, it underwrote the loan and it sought to verify all the representations made by Ms. Burkhart, whether it be her income, her creditworthiness, or her eligibility. And the bank simply did what it does with substantially all of its other VA loans. It asked the VA whether she's eligible, and VA responded saying she's actually not eligible, which then prompted her second request for an explanation as to why she's not eligible in light of her being in possession of a COE, and that kickstarts the proceedings.
Was it the same people who responded to the bank saying she's actually not eligible who had issued the original certificate of eligibility?
Again,
I don't mean physical person, the same office, the same bureaucratic silo in the VA that did this?
I don't know the exact answer, whether I can't say for certain if it was, but my intuition says that it most likely was due to the centralization.
Well, let me ask you this. Suppose the same people who had issued the certificate of eligibility didn't pick up their asserted error, and she got the loan.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's a guarantee. It's really a loan guarantee. It's not the loan. The bank makes the loan. She defaults, or she misses a payment.
Mm-hmm.
The bank shows up at the VA and says, hey, you guaranteed this. Does the VA get to say we made a mistake?
No.
You're stuck?
Yes. Under those facts, which are not our facts here, then Section 3721 would come into play and render that loan and its guarantee incontestable. But again, those aren't our facts.
And, I get your position.
Just to illustrate the process into how this is a nice dovetail into the second argument here regarding 3721. On 3721, what's incontestable under that statute is evidence of guarantee. And that phrase, evidence of guarantee, appears in three places in Chapter 37. It appears in, obviously, 3721. It appears in 3744, which is not relevant here because that section refers to small business loans. And it refers to it in Section 3702. And 3702C explains what a COE is and what a COE is not, and it also explains what evidence of guarantee is. 3702 illustrates what basically is a three-step process. A veteran or a surviving spouse comes in with a certificate of eligibility, or an ED-214, as the case may be. They apply for a loan. The bank undertakes the processes that banks do to underwrite and issue a loan. And then the bank makes certification. It issues a report to VA, which by regulation must be within 60 days. And then the secretary responds with evidence of guarantee, or as the statute says, with a loan guarantee certificate or other evidence of guarantee. 3702 defines what evidence of guarantee is, and it's the very last step in the process, as opposed to the very first step in the process, which is what appellant argues here. And the construction of having a COE being the targeted focus of Section 3721 simply doesn't make sense within the statutory scheme here. Again, typically a DD-214 functions as a certificate of eligibility. So when service members leave service and become veterans, under appellant's construction here, 1 minute after they walk out the door with their fresh, clean, crisp DD-214, there would already be an incontestable loan, even though that veteran may not even have a job, certainly hasn't visited a bank, asked for a loan, hasn't identified any property. But under this construction, there would already be an incontestable loan, and that simply makes no sense. What does make sense, and what's entirely consistent with both the statutory and the regulatory scheme, is that after a loan is issued, once it's certified to the secretary as being consistent with all the various factors and requirements of section of Chapter 37, then the loan becomes incontestable. And exactly as you noted, Your Honor, Judge Allen, 3721 functions to secure and facilitate the secondary market for these loans. And that's explained in the authority that appellant herself cites, Mount Vernon Savings Bank versus Gleason. The court there specifically noted that the purpose of Section 3721 is to motivate a secondary market, because as in any other context, no one wants to buy a lawsuit. No one wants to buy a loan from a bank with the potential litigation against the government hanging over it. So Congress simply created 3721 to make these loans incontestable once they are officially guaranteed by the secretary, to allow banks to buy and sell loans with confidence that the guarantees underlying them will be honored.
Now, I have a question about the process here. She received the certificate of eligibility in 2007, and this goes back to a question that I was asking appellant's counsel. Is that an actual decision, that issuance of a certificate of eligibility? Is that an actual VA decision that would be covered by 3.105A? I mean, should they have found clear and unmistakable error in that decision? And here it looks like, correct me if I'm wrong, she just reapplied. They denied her, and she didn't contest it, or she just reapplied with a new application, right?
Are you referring to kind of how these new decisions
arose? Yeah, yeah. I'm a little... She doesn't seem to have gotten notice that the... I guess she did get some notice, but I'm not sure it's sufficient under 3.105 that there was, like, clear and unmistakable error in the 2007 issuance of the COE. So that's why that leads to my question. Was the issuance of the COE in 2007, would you consider that a decision to which 3.105A and other regs would apply?
As you answer that, because this, I think, ties together a question with Judge Greenberg, because here it's the only reason I can think of why it matters what happened when the bank picked up the phone and called the VA and said, hey, is this still good? I know they didn't pick up the phone, but the basic idea. Because the way I understand Judge Barton's question is the VA had made a decision. It might have been wrong to issue the COE. Is it enough for them to simply say when the bank calls, oh, we were wrong, we're just going to tear it up? Because in most other situations, they wouldn't be able to just do that. Mm-hmm. That's how I understand the question that Judge Bartley's asking and would have been my own question. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
as well.
Me too.
If you could bear with me for one moment, I'm getting some signals from my co-counsel. I'd just like to speak with him briefly if I could.
Absolutely.
Sure.
Well, ultimately, to answer your question, we have to understand also what a COE is and what a COE isn't. A COE, again, and this is made clear by Section 3702C, a COE is not a grant of benefits. A COE is simply prima facie evidence, basically, of veteran status. It's the same thing. It is truly the equivalent of a DD-214. But insofar as there was a question put to VA here, am I eligible to seek a VA loan? Because, of course, Ms. Burkhart doesn't herself have a DD-214. She needs to obtain the COE on another form. Insofar as there was a question put to VA, that would effectively be a decision. But, again, the COE doesn't actually grant benefits. There's no...
No, but it would have had to be. Let's just stick there. Let's just assume that in 2000, whenever, prior to 2007, when it was issued the first time in mistake, okay? Assume she asks at the beginning of 2007, hey, I want my certificate of eligibility. And VA doesn't make a mistake. They say, no, you're not entitled to it. She would be able to appeal that determination, right?
She would.
Right. Doesn't that mean by definition it is a decision?
Well, it certainly is a decision insofar as there was a question put to VA, and VA provided an answer to that question.
Right, so having then answered the question in her favor in 2007, don't they owe her some special process to reverse that, quote, decision later?
Title 38 does indeed have provisions. We see them most often with respect to severance and rating reductions that require particular statutory advance notice, and there's different procedural protections involved in those. I'm not aware of any analogous provisions pertaining to Chapter 37. And if the question is whether there's been due process here, whether Ms. Burkhart received notice and an opportunity to participate in proceedings related to her COE, there's been no failure of due process here. She asked us again. It was clearly explained to her why she's not eligible.
Well, she asked again only because the bank communicated with VA and VA said, oh, wait, this was our bad.
This was our bad, right?
And so, leaving aside the Constitution, that old constitutional law professor in me hates to do that, but leave it aside for a second, just sticking with Title 38, why wouldn't Judge Bartley's question be the relevant question, which is VA would have had to go through the process of establishing clear and unmistakable error, which maybe they could have done, mm-hmm. but they didn't do it.
I don't know that I would necessarily agree with you, Judge Allen. Certainly in the notice letters here, the magic words clear and unmistakable don't appear on them, but it's clear that VA explained to Ms. Burkhart what error was made and what the error was. And again, she was notified initially that her 1151 award does not carry with it ancillary benefits. And then once the mistake was discovered, it was clearly explained to her again that her DIC is not predicated on 1310 or 1318, but is rather predicated on 1151, and explained that the decision finding her to, in effect, be a veteran earlier was incorrect because the death in question here was not actually service-connected, and her award of 1151 under 1151 makes that clear. And she certainly has received plenty of due process here, and that, again, it was explained to her. She was given a notice of her appellate rights, which she exercised. She submitted a notice of disagreement. VA issued her a statement of the case. She submitted a Form 9. She had a board hearing. She had a board decision. She's been fully able to participate in these proceedings here, and here we are. There's been no failure of due process here. All process that would be applicable to any veteran due to any discovery of error in a previous decision, Ms. Burkhart has received every bit of that process here. I see my time is about to expire. Thank you, Your Honor. Again, the Secretary would submit that the March 2016 decision should be affirmed in all respects.
Mr. Toomey, you may proceed with rebuttal.
Thank you, Judge Bartley, Your Honors. With respect to the statutory interpretation question, briefly, I just want to point out that 1151 isn't quite as limited as the Secretary has portrayed it. He's overlooking the Hornick case, which applies 1151 to 38 U.S.C. 1159, which says nothing about compensation at all. It says service connection for any disability, the status service connection status for any death or disability shall be protected if it's been enforced for 10 years. And this court applied 1151 in that context, construing the two statutes together to determine that 1151 applied. Now, given those are both in Chapter 11, but I don't think that the court's holding was necessarily turned on that in that case. What the court was looking to was the broader context of the statutes as a whole and how they work together within the confines of Title 38. With respect to the discussion around which 3721 and Jeff Greenberg's questions around how did this come about that she was unable to use the 2007 COE, respectfully, we would disagree with the Secretary that it doesn't matter how it happened, because the Secretary is the one who prevented Mrs. Burkhart from exercising the COE in order to get the VA loan guarantee. In other words, it was some action by the Secretary is the reason that she wasn't able to close the loan with the bank. Now, why is that important? Because the Secretary himself has conceded, had the bank given her the loan, they'd be on the hook. So it can't be, respectfully, we don't think it can be that the Secretary can just prevent that from happening and then say, sorry, too bad, we stopped you from doing that in order to save ourselves so from having to pay the loan. So we don't, you know, our position is that the Secretary can't benefit from stopping the action in that sense. The other point with respect to the 3721 argument is the Secretary is suggesting for the first time now that any evidence of guarantee doesn't include a certificate of eligibility. I think based on 3702C, and that's just not an argument that was raised in the brief, but also not the case. It's incorrect. 370. If you look at 3702, for several reasons. First, if you look at 3702C,
1 second, Your Honors. If you look at 3702C, it does mention certificate of eligibility, and then in the last sentence, it also says the Secretary shall endorse on the veteran's eligibility certificate the amount and type of guarantee used. So that, in addition to 3721, which says any evidence of guarantee, it doesn't say, as the Secretary suggested, a loan guarantee certificate. If it meant a loan guarantee certificate, it would have said a loan guarantee certificate in 3721 I'm talking about now. It says any evidence of guarantee. It doesn't say a loan guarantee certificate. So what the Secretary was suggesting is that's the only evidence of guarantee, but the statute doesn't say that. And so our position is that any evidence of guarantee includes a COE. Now, what lends credence to that notion is, as I said before, the lender's pamphlet. This is pamphlet 26-7 that VA gives to lenders. In Chapter 2-2, it tells lenders that a certificate of eligibility is the only reliable proof that they can rely on. So how could evidence of guarantee not include what they're telling the banks to use? So we just don't think the Secretary's position is correct on what evidence of guarantee can mean. And then with respect to the equitable point, Your Honor, I think this is something Judge Greenberg was getting at, is to the extent there's been a mistake here, it goes against the fundamental scheme of Title 38 to place the burden of that mistake on Mrs. Burkhardt when it's not her fault. The entire system is intended to be favor, you know, veterans and grant them, look upon them favorably. And so here, to the extent the court, you know, does nothing else, we'd ask that the court look, take that into account when considering the equitable factors, and, if nothing else.
Well, let me ask you this. The Secretary's argument is that, unlike my colleague, I do see a matter of constitutional dimension here. This is an important economic benefit intended by Congress to be given to veterans and other people, including, in this case, a surviving spouse. The Secretary says, well, she got all the due process that the Constitution or the Congress intended to have. But doesn't the Secretary refer only to this so-called due process after the action complained of? I'm concerned with the due process she didn't get, or the dead veteran's surviving spouse didn't get, before she got stuck in this system. What happened in terms of the veteran or the surviving spouse's due process between 2004, 2007, and whenever the bank called or whatever they did with the certificate of 2007? What about that?
That's absolutely right.
Shouldn't that concern us?
That's absolutely right, Judge Greenberg. We agree completely, and I think it's twofold. The veteran...
That goes to the point of, is it inequitable or unfair? And can we do it? Can we supply a remedy as a court here and now in the context of our decision, or do we have to send it back to the VA for another decade?
And absolutely, Judge Greenberg, and then that's, to close, in terms of equitable considerations, there's no question that...
By the way, there is a scheme, I think. It's a bunch of regulations. I think at least one, where if you give a benefit to a veteran or you confer a benefit, there's a certain regulatory method, statutory first and then regulatory method, of taking it away. She didn't get that, did she?
No, she didn't, and neither did her husband. He was entitled to this. It's undisputed that he was entitled to this benefit, and he lost it as a result of his death in VA care. And so it's twofold. Not only did she not get it, but neither did her husband. And that goes not only to our statutory construction argument in order to avoid certain interpretation, absurd results under the interpretation of the statute, but to the equitable points. Just in closing, Your Honors, it's clear that Mrs. Burkhardt has been prejudiced here, and this is 2007 we're talking about, and then 2013 she was denied the ability to use the 2007 COE. And it's in the record at 54 to 56, housing prices have skyrocketed, interest rates have skyrocketed. She's just, She's been strung along essentially by the VA and hasn't been able to exercise these benefits. So we would ask that the court, consider the equitable factors, consider the statute in our favor, and apply 3721. If there are no further questions, Your Honor.
No, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Toomey. Well, thank you all very much for your arguments. The court wants to especially recognize that Mr. Toomey is representing Ms. Burkhart pro bono and expresses gratitude for that, and also expresses gratitude to Mr. Gore and to Mr. Daly for representing the Secretary's position here. The case is submitted for consideration, and we will come down and greet counsel.
All rise.